From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! In Iraq, U.S. forces launch a major offensive in Najaf. We'll speak with Professor Asad Abu Khalil about the attack on the Imam Ali Shrine. Millions of voters in Venezuela head to the polls Sunday to vote on whether to recall President Hugo Chavez. We'll have a debate. And death row prisoner Ryan Matthews is freed. He was 17 years old when he was accused of murder. He's now 24. We'll speak with his mother and his attorney. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of U.S. troops have launched a major attack on the Iraqi city of Najaf, one of the holiest cities in the Muslim world. Shortly after dawn, U.S. tanks moved into the city center to block off roads to the holy Imam Ali shrine, where the Prophet Muhammad's son-in-law Ali is buried. Helicopter gunships flew overhead. War planes bombed portions of the massive Shiite cemetery, where some backers of cleric Muqtada al-Sadr are stationed. Thick black smoke poured into the sky. Thousands of residents in Najaf have fled the city to escape the fighting, which has raged for the past week. Agence France-Presse is reporting the downtown area looks like a ghost city. The New York Times estimates the U.S. has tripled the number of troops around Najaf to about 5,000. U.S. military spokesperson told the press, quote, "major operations to destroy the militia have begun." Sadr told his followers, quote, "I hope you keep fighting even if you see me detained or martyred." In Basra and Baghdad, thousands of Shiite Iraqis took to the streets to protest the U.S. attack on Najaf. Shiites around the world are warning the U.S. against directly attacking the holy shrine. One Shiite cleric in Los Angeles said, quote, "Any attack on the city will destroy America's future in Iraq completely. It will completely discredit America and make it the new tyrant in the eyes of Shia worldwide." U.S. forces have also attacked the Shiite city of Qut repeatedly, killing 72 people over the last 24 hours. Agence France-Presse is reporting across Iraq, 165 people have been killed, nearly 600 wounded over the past 24 hours. In other Iraq news, the former head of Saddam Hussein's nuclear program has told the BBC Iraq abandoned its plans to develop nuclear weapons in 1991. The Washington Post today published a 3,000-word front-page story examining how the paper downplayed critics of the Iraq war before the U.S. attacked last year. Pentagon correspondent Thomas Ricks revealed how in October 2002, editors killed a piece of his entitled Doubts that outlined how many senior Pentagon officials were reluctant about plans to attack Iraq. Ricks also added, quote, "The paper was not front-paging stuff. Administration assertions were on the front page. Things that challenged the administration were on page A18 on Sunday or A24 on Monday. There was an attitude among editors, look, we're going to war. Why do we even worry about all this contrary stuff?" Executive editor Leonard Downey Jr. admitted mistakes were made. He said, quote, "We were so focused on trying to figure out what the administration was doing that we were not giving the same play to people who said it wouldn't be a good idea to go to war and were questioning the administration's rationale." Federal prosecutors indicated yesterday enemy combatant Yasser Issam Hamdi may soon be released. The U.S.-born citizen has been held since 2001. He's never been charged with a crime and has been held largely incommunicado without access to an attorney because President Bush deemed him to be an enemy combatant. In June, the Supreme Court ruled as a U.S. citizen, Hamdi cannot be held indefinitely without access to the U.S. legal system. Yesterday, Hamdi's attorneys and federal prosecutors made the surprise announcement that they were negotiating terms for his release. Part of the deal may call on Hamdi to renounce his citizenship, move to Saudi Arabia, and promise not to sue the U.S. government. The U.S. Army announced yesterday Pentagon auditors have found that Halliburton cannot properly document more than $1.8 billion worth of work done in Iraq and Kuwait. The Pentagon's now threatening to withhold about $600 million in payments to the company, which was once headed by Vice President Dick Cheney. And the Financial Times reports that Senator John Kerry's campaign signaled yesterday its intention on placing the controversy surrounding Halliburton as a central theme of its bid for the White House. On the campaign front, Senator Kerry vowed yesterday in Nevada to revise last year's Medicare law to allow the importation of cheaper drugs from Canada. Yesterday, Kerry received the endorsement of the 3-million-member Alliance for Retired Americans. The Washington Post is reporting that a Republican-linked group called People of Color United has begun buying radio ads on black radio stations attacking Senator Kerry as, quote, rich, white, and wishy-washy. The ads also attack Kerry's wife, Teresa Hines Kerry, for boasting of her African roots. One ad states, quote, his wife says she's an African American. While technically true, I don't believe a white woman raised in Africa surrounded by servants qualifies. A Kerry spokesperson criticized the ad, saying, quote, first a group of right-wing swiftboat veterans began smearing John Kerry's military service, and now another group has resorted to playing racial politics. The ads are largely funded by a white Republican named Patrick Rooney, who founded the firm Medical Savings Insurance, which specializes in the type of medical savings accounts created by Bush's 2003 Medicare prescription drug legislation. The New York Times is reporting that Senate Democrats are suggesting they will not block Congressmember Peter Goss's nomination as CIA chief because such a move could backfire politically. Sudanese President Omar Hassan met with tribal leaders from Darfur this week and asked them to help bring stability to the region. This comes as Human Rights Watch reports that Janjaweed militias continue to rape women and girls in the western Darfur region. Meanwhile, UN medical experts say there's a threat of a hepatitis outbreak in Darfur refugee camps. 22 people have died already, and the disease is spreading quickly because of poor sanitation in the camps. And in New York, two groups filed suit yesterday to gain access to a major demonstration on the Great Lawn of Central Park just before the Republican National Convention in New York. The National Council of Arab Americans and the Answer Coalition are being represented by the National Lawyers Guild in their bid to reverse the city's refusal to grant access to the lawn for a protest. Meanwhile, the group United for Peace and Justice has also announced plans to sue the city over denying them a permit for the August 29th protest in the city. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers and those listening in on the internet on democracynow.org.
Well, Juan, congratulations on this major historic conference of over 8,000 journalists, the Unity Conference.
Yes, it actually exceeded our expectations. We were looking for at least 7,000 people, and the final numbers were 8,200 were registered, and mostly journalists of color, but a huge number of the top media executives as well as community leaders from various organizations of color throughout the United States. So it was a huge success, got a lot of coverage on C-SPAN and even in the national press, thanks to the fact that both President Bush and John Kerry, as well as Colin Powell, attended and were questioned by the journalists on a variety of issues.
From each of the major journalist organizations, National Association of Black Journalists, National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Asian American Journalists Association, Native American Journalists. Over the last few days, we've had a few of them on and playing their questions. The question for George Bush from the reporter from the Chicago Defender. He started and ended the questioning. One on legacy. If he's against affirmative action, is he against legacy college choosing based on who your father was?
Right.
That's an interesting question.
You also played the segment where Mark Trahan asked Bush about tribal sovereignty. Obviously, the first time in Bush's life he'd ever been asked a question about Native Americans, and his handlers hadn't even prepared him, even though there were hundreds of Native American journalists at the convention. So it showed the
and
total
John
lack
Kerry
of
had been asked the question the day before.
Yes.
So even in terms of just checking out what he was asked for the next day,
right? And Kerry did a fairly good job responding to the question, recognizing the history of the genocidal wars that had been waged against Native Americans, and at least began to offer some possibilities of changes in policy and Native American policy by the government.
And Colin Powell said there that he would not be attending the Republican convention.
Yes. So I think it surprised a lot of people, and he was grilled pretty toughly, especially by Susan Malveaux of CNN. So that I think overall, you know, there was none of the candidates, none of the political figures were allowed to speak unless they agreed to answer questions by a panel of journalists. So I think overall it was a good opportunity to raise the kinds of issues that the national press rarely asks of presidential candidates. Questions about native sovereignty, about affirmative action, about urban policies, about immigration. So on a range of questions, they were hit, on a range of topics, they were hit with questions they normally don't get much of from the national press.
I understand that John Kerry was tougher to get as a guest than George Bush was. Kerry first offering Edwards, Elizabeth Edwards, that is.
Right. And they resisted actually till the very end. And it was only when some of us made it clear to their key party people that both Bush and Powell were coming and that the Democrats were going to look very bad if they didn't at least have a major figure there. And then at the end, they were trying to get a second Democrat invited. And we said, no, it's too late. You know, we have a Secretary of State, we have a president. And if Kerry wants to come, fine, but we're not going to accept. They were trying to press a variety of figures to come. And at the last moment, after Kerry accepted. But we said, if Kerry comes, that's fine.
Well, if folks see Kerry or Bush clips with that look like they're sitting in a universe with stars in the background lights, that comes from the Unity Convention. I continue to see the quotes of them from that convention. And Juan, the Unity umbrella organization of the four major journalists of color organization released a report on the racial composition of the press corps in this country. And you also, with Joe Torres of National Association of Hispanic Journalists, gave out thousands of your report.
Yes. Well, Joe and I issued a study that we've been working on for quite a while. And this was done independent of my role as president of NAHJ or a member of the board of the Unity. It was an attempt to look, it's a pamphlet that we call How Long Must We Wait? The Fight for Racial and Ethnic Equality in the American News Media. And it's the result of about 2 years of work that Joe Torres, who's the deputy director of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and I have been working on, looking at the history of racism in the American news media from the early days of the modern newspaper in the early 1800s, through the rise of radio, through the rise of television, and documenting precisely why it is that there are today so few African Americans, Latinos, Asians, or Native Americans working in mainstream media or the media in general. Because unfortunately, when it comes to the question of scarcity of people of color, the progressive and the left media in the United States share many of the same problems that the mainstream media does. So we took a look at how is it possible after so many years, after about 160, 70 years of a tradition of journalism among African Americans, from Freedom's Journal in 1827 to among Latinos from the first Spanish language newspaper in Mississippi in 1808, from the Golden Hills News, the first Chinese language newspaper in 1854 in San Francisco, how it is that despite all these years of people of color being involved in journalism, there are still so few working in the American news media, and also how that has led to systematic and constant misrepresentation, distortion, and stereotyping of communities of color within the media. So we've taken a broad look at the entire history of that and shown how the government policies as well as private industry policies have created that wholesale exclusion, as well as how that all links up to the current movement for media reform and for greater diversity in voices. And so we did it as individuals, knowing that the boards of many of our associations, including my association, were not completely united on this, but we wanted to spark a debate on the subject, and we were able to do that at the Unity Convention.
If people want to get a hold of this report, how long must we wait? Where can you go?
Well, it will be available on the Democracy Now! website. In a PDF file for people to download by early next week. We're just making a few corrections from the final pamphlet. But by early next week, anybody who wants to get a copy will be able to do so just by going to the Democracy Now! Website.
And that's democracynow.org. As we turn now to the latest news, what is happening in Iraq, specifically in Najaf? Juan?
Well, U.S. forces have launched a major offensive in the Iraqi city of Najaf, vowing to defeat a weak long uprising by supporters of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Tanks backed by helicopter gunships moved to seal off the revered Imam Ali Shrine in the center of the city on Thursday. Aircraft and artillery pounded the city's historic cemetery where militiamen have taken up positions in recent days.
Fierce fighting erupted in Najaf on August 5th between U.S. troops and militants of Sadr's Mehdi army. U.S. commanders accused the militia of launching attacks from the cemetery swept through it, killing hundreds, according to the military. Sadr's forces put the death toll only in the dozens. Five U.S. troops have also been killed, along with 20 Iraqi officers. The latest clashes broke out in the early morning today in Iraq as U.S. forces launched the offensive after initially calling it off last night. New York Times reports the U.S. has tripled its force around Najaf to some 5,000 troops. There are also a few hundred Iraqi soldiers. Using loudspeakers, troops have been warning residents to leave the area, saying, quote, to the residents of Najaf, coalition forces are purging the city from the Mahdi army. This according to USA Today. Thousands have fled the city. Sadr has called on his followers to keep fighting, even if he himself is captured or killed.
In what could prove to be a dangerous escalation of the conflict, the U.S. is saying that the Marines have been given permission by the Najaf government to enter the shrine of Imam Ali. Iraq's interim deputy prime minister, Ibrahim Jafari, earlier called on the U.S. to pull out of Najaf completely. The 1,000-year-old mosque of Imam Ali and its nearby cemetery, where hundreds of thousands of Muslims are buried, is one of the holiest sites in Shiite Islam. Shiite leaders around the world, including Iran's top cleric, have condemned the U.S. presence in Najaf and warned against hitting the mosque. One Shiite told the Los Angeles Times, quote, any attack on that city will destroy America's future in Iraq completely. It will completely discredit America and make it the new tyrant in the eyes of Shias worldwide.
We're going to go first to independent reporter, the Independent of London, Donald McIntyre, who's in Baghdad. He's headed to Najaf right now. Can you give us the latest reports on what's happening?
Well, I think to some extent it's more of the same, but I think what has been evident over the last few hours is that the U.S. forces have really tried to tighten this cordon that they have put round the Imam Ali compound, the mosque compound, which your report referred to, and the cemetery, which the two areas together being the base of the Shiite guerrillas who are led by Muqtada al-Sadr. And what is unclear, I think, still, is how far the Americans are really prepared to risk the kind of reaction that your report was talking about if they really move into, in a heavy way, the compound of the Imam Ali shrine itself. And at the moment, that does not seem to be happening. I mean, they don't seem to be either bombarding or overrunning it in a sense that would cause enormous destruction to the shrine itself. Now, the U.S. military said earlier this week that the governor of Najaf had permission to do that because the al-Sadr's people were using it as a military base, effectively, and that therefore they had forfeited their right, really, or the right in international law to keep the American forces out of it. They now had the right. Well, although the military have said that, I think there is considerable doubt. I mean, there must be some hesitation on the part of the U.S. forces about doing this operation in that way, precisely because of the kind of worldwide Muslim reaction it would provoke. So this is a very difficult situation, I think, literally, for the Americans, if they are determined, as they say they are, to defeat Muqtada al-Sadr's forces.
Donald McIntyre speaking to us from Baghdad, headed to Najaf today of the London Independent. When we come back from our break, we'll speak with Asad Abu Khalil, a professor from California, talking about the battle in Najaf. Stay with us. Music by Tortoise here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we turn now to Asad Abu Khalil, professor of political science at California State University Stanislaus and visiting professor at UC Berkeley, author of several books, as late as The Battle for Saudi Arabia, Royalty, Fundamentalism, and Global Power. He is running a new blog called The Angry Arab News Service at angryarab.blogspot.com. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Abu Khalil. Can you talk about the significance of the mosque?
Well, before I proceed, I should say that there's some updates from what I saw in the Arabic media before I got on the phone. And first, it is absolutely not clear that there is even permission by the puppet Iraqi government for the United States forces to enter into the shrine. In fact, a source, a high official in the Ministry of Interior, which is set up by the Americans, confirmed today that there is absolutely no permission by any Iraqi for U.S. forces to enter. And the deputy governor of Najaf himself, also handpicked by the Americans, today resigned and accused U.S. forces of terrorism. We also should mention that for the Arab world watching and the Iraqis, there is a war outside of the confines of Najaf. U.S. forces over the last several hours have bombed various areas, Al-Qut in Iraq, in Baghdad, as well as in Najaf. We're talking about a city over 600,000 of people living there. So it's not easy to say that we are asking to leave so that we can do whatever we need to do. This is of paramount importance, not only for the Shiites of the world, who are some 15% of all Muslims, but this man's shrine is also holy for all Muslims worldwide. He happens to be the son-in-law, the first male convert to Islam after Muhammad's first wife. He also is married to Muhammad's daughter, so his lineage is considered to be extremely sacred for all Muslims worldwide. And there is even significance to the cemetery where all U.S. forces are hunkered down. These are millions of people over the centuries of Muslims worldwide who will that they want to be buried in zones, in grounds that are holy because of its proximity to this shrine. So with all that going on, one can imagine how Shiites and non-Shiites are reacting to the scenes of bloodshed and to the destruction occurring to historic areas, as well as the killing of innocent civilians. I mean, the United States 2 days ago bragged that 300 were killed in one night or two. And of course, it leads one to ask, how does the United States know that they were all terrorists? I mean, do they have special devices where they can pinpoint from the air to determine who are the terrorists and who are the innocent people? Apparently not.
Professor Abu Halila, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the potential for the Battle of Najaf creating deeper schisms within the Iraqi, those who are supporting the occupation, there's been talk, for instance, of some provincial governors in the south talking about separating from the occupation government. What's the potential for greater fragmentation within Iraqi society as a result of this battle?
I personally think that most Iraqis will work against that, and in fact, a source in Assad's quarters yesterday denied any ambition like that. This was a threat issued in the various massive spontaneous demonstrations that erupted yesterday in various cities in Karbala and Nasiriyah and elsewhere, trying to put pressure on the Iraqi puppet government to desist from encouraging the Americans to do so. We have to say that perhaps events in Iraq today are dictated by American electoral politics, very much like the American declared war on terrorism. I mean, the capture of somebody in Pakistan wouldn't have gotten the attention it got if it wasn't an election year and George W. Bush wanted to get credit and make it a bigger deal than it is. Similarly, I mean, if anybody thinks that there was some uprising declared and the Americans are responding to it, the person hasn't been following what's going on in Iraq. I mean, it seems that the American forces are looking for a fight, hoping to capture al-Sadr or kill him just before the Republican convention so that he can be crowned without any disturbances from Iraq. But if that was the intention, it's going to backfire. Because even if you kill Muqtada al-Sadr, there is a mass movement in Iraq today, and it's putting pressure on the Shiite members of the Iraqi puppet government itself. And let us remember that the highest-ranking Shiite in the government, the deputy president, Ibrahim al-Ja'far, yesterday on Al Jazeera itself, and the selection of Al Jazeera is significant because it was closed down by the Americans, said that he called on all Americans to leave Al-Najaf entirely. And in fact, the headquarters of the party of the Iraqi puppet prime minister, Iyad Alawi, was burnt in the city of Nasiriyah twice in the last 2 days. And of course, there were massive demonstrations in Karbala. And just now, the Arabic media are reporting about a statement put out by one of the highest Shiite authorities in the world today, Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah in Lebanon, also strongly condemning what the Americans are doing. And the last addition is that Ayatollah Sistani's representative in Karbala came out strongly against the Americans, calling on them to leave the city too.
Let's talk about Sistani for a minute. The Washington Post is reporting that some within the U.S. military believe that Iraq's leading Shiite cleric, the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, gave them a green light to carry out the attack on Sadr's forces. Last week, just as the U.S. attacks began, Sistani left Iraq for London, reportedly for treatment of a heart condition. The trip marks Sistani's first trip out of Najaf in 6 years.
I wouldn't believe that to be the case. My impression, and I interviewed a lot of people in Lebanon when I was there recently, including the head of Hezbollah, the Party of God, Hassan Nasrallah, who keeps close touch with people in Iraq. And the impression I got is that Ayatollah Sistani is not as distant from al-Sadr as we are led to believe by the American press and the Americans. And he also told me that, in fact, in the last showdown, that Sistani himself made it very clear that he would not stand for a crackdown that would lead to the American forces entering into the city of Najaf. What I read in the Arabic press is a different story. What I read is that the British have learned, because of logistical preparation, that Sistani was leaving for medical reasons into United Kingdom, and they in turn told the Americans. The Americans saw that they will take the opportunity of his absence in order to launch this massive attack on the city. But I mean, that is going to be to backfire, because that is not going to end a movement that extends into various areas of Iraq. And in fact, American Commission Public Opinion Service in Iraq in the last showdown indicated that Sadr is extremely popular in areas where Shiites predominate, as well as in areas where Sunnis predominate. I mean, his popularity reaches something like 70 or 75%. So if Sistani is seen to be complicit in what is going on, I would say his leadership would be severely shattered, if not undermined.
Assad Abu Khalil, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. Professor of Political Science at California State University, Stanislaus, visiting professor now at UC Berkeley. His blogspot, angryarab.blogspot.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, Juan, we move now from one oil country to another.
Yes, we move to Venezuela. Opponents of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez say they will only accept the results of this weekend's recall referendum if international organizations acting as observers approve them. Millions of voters in Venezuela will head to the polls Sunday to vote on whether to recall Chavez from office. Last month, the National Electoral Council announced opponents of Chavez had gathered enough signatures to force a recall. If he is defeated in the referendum, presidential elections will be held within 30 days. But some recent polls say Chavez will likely survive the recall vote on Sunday. One Bush administration official said, quote, he's definitely got momentum on his side, and admitted that Washington is unlikely to be happy with the outcome. This, according to the Interpress service.
U.S.-Venezuela relations have turned sour ever since Chavez was elected president in 1998. In heated speeches, Chavez has condemned the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, threatened to cut off oil sales to the United States, as well as praise Cuban President Fidel Castro. More than $1 million in U.S. government money has been given to Venezuelan opposition groups for democracy training programs under the auspices of the National Endowment for Democracy, a private agency funded entirely by the U.S. government. $54,000 of those funds have gone to the group that gathered the signatures that led to Sunday's referendum. Chavez supporters have complained the U.S. is meddling in Venezuelan affairs as well as the vote. Supporters have also criticized the U.S. for supporting a coup attempt in April 2002. Chavez was removed from power by a coalition of military officials and business and media leaders, but returned to office 2 days later. Today we're going to have a debate. We're joined by Martin Sanchez, who is webmaster of Vaporia.org, the main grassroots website for Chavez supporters, also co-editor of the news site VenezuelaAnalysis.com. He joins us from Caracas. And we're joined by Jorge Cambellas, editor of opposition website 11abril.com, U.S. coordinator for the referendum to recall President Chavez. Why don't we begin with Jorge Cambellas? Yes. Tell us where you think the vote will go at this point, the vote, of course, on Sunday.
Hi. First of all, thank you for being in your program. It's an honor and it's a pleasure to be in your program. I think the vote is going to go for the yes option. I mean, it's for the recall the mandate of the president, of Hugo Chavez. And really, you were talking about some polls. There are a lot of polls right now going around. I can mention some of them that goes in favor of the opposition. And as you were saying, some of them go in favor of the government. Now, I would like to say something also. In the past, we have seen this in other countries. One example was in Nicaragua in 1989, where the polls were saying that the president at that moment, Daniel Ortega, was going to win the elections. And the truth was that he lost the elections. And the reason, at least the analysis of that, it was that a lot of people was afraid of giving their opinion in public polls because they were afraid to be in blacklist. So when the vote is secret, people is going to express their opinion. I'm pretty sure the yes option is going to win.
And Martin Sanchez, you are a supporter of keeping President Chavez in office. What do you think, your sense now of how the vote will go and why?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. Actually, being in Caracas, I think, gives you a whole different perspective on things. And if you go outside the upper class areas where anti-Chavez sentiment is big, you will notice that there's an overwhelming support for President Chavez. And I think it's not that there's some polls that favor the opposition. I haven't seen a recent poll, a poll that is less it's new at least, you know, in the last month that actually gives the opposition the upper hand. All polls and you can, you know, try to do a search on the web or try to find a quote from an opposition pollster. You'll see that even the pollsters who are openly aligned with the opposition give President Chavez the upper hand. He's been gaining momentum for the last 6 months, and right now the difference is it hovers between 9% and 31%, according to which poll you choose.
Well, can I talk a little bit about it?
Jorge Combellas.
Yes. If you have seen the Central University poll, and the difference between this poll and all the other previous poll is that this is a close poll. I mean, people really, in this case, what they think, they put it in a paper, they close the paper, and they put it in the box, and it's completely, it's a secret, so nobody knows. I mean, the person who's conducting the poll doesn't know what that person put in the paper. And that recent poll, and it's the most important university in Venezuela, it was 43 in favor of the government and 55 in favor of the opposition. So I'm not sure which polls are you looking at, but also you have the Gallup poll that it was in favor of the opposition, and you have Consultores 21 poll that was also in favor of the opposition. But anyway, going more ahead about the polls, we can start discussing about what's going on in the polls, and depends on which poll are you reading, you're going to see different results. The important thing is that the real poll will be on Sunday, and there is the moment that really the people is going to express their opinion, if they want Chavez to continue in power, or if they want him to get out of the power.
Get away from the polls for a second and get to some of the substance of the battle here. It appears, though, all sides agree that President Chavez has had a rebound of public support in recent months, largely apparently because the rise in oil prices, worldwide oil prices, as a result of the continuing troubles in the Middle East, have made it possible for him to devote much more money to social programs that he initially had promised. I'm wondering if you'd like to comment, Martin Sanchez, on the social programs that have been directed largely at Chavez's base.
Yeah, well, I'm quite happy that Chavez is using that oil money for the social programs, because that's something that people have a lot of expectancy. When Chavez took power, people expected to, you know, have the problem solved. And when you go to poor neighborhoods, you see that they have a local market now that sells food at very low prices, and they have a doctor that they can go to in their neighborhood. You know, that's something that keeps people happy, and I don't see what the problem is with Chavez implementing those social programs. He should have done that since the beginning of his presidency. The opposition accused Chavez of buying votes, but I think actually using oil money to for the social programs and to give low income interest credits to co-ops and to small businesses, it's good. I don't see that as a negative thing. And in fact, yeah, it has cause and effect. Chavez has gained momentum, but the social programs have been implemented in the last 2 years, so it's not something that's just happening now.
Jorge Cambias, your response to that, and just overall the surge that President Hugo Chavez has enjoyed over the last weeks.
Right. So about the social programs, I mean, I agree with social programs and investing in education and in health of the people, et cetera. But it's really suspicious after almost 6 years in power that Chavez has done nothing at all for the poor people, that he starts with these programs just before the recall referendum and expending about $3 billion in this program. I agree that, I mean, there is a lot of poverty. Poverty has increased a lot in the last 5 years during this government. It was, to give you some numbers, about 50% of the people were under human conditions, living under human conditions, and in the last 2 years, that number has increased to 65%. So things are really going really wrong in the country, especially when what you are talking about, we have revenues for oil from oil that are really high in Venezuela, and you just start spending that about 3 months ago. It's really suspicious, especially when you have a recall right now in 3 days.
But Jorge Cambias, you would admit that part of the problems for the economic dislocation of the past few years has had to do with the constant internal strife, the strikes that the opposition mounted, created the crippling of the oil industry, certainly at least for the last 2 years, has created enormous economic problems for Venezuela.
Yeah, there has been a lot of problems with economics, but let me remember you, the strike came into place because there were social problems. I mean, it wasn't a strike of the people with money. It was a strike of the unions. I mean, it was a strike of all the opposition coalition. And I'm talking about leftist parties. I mean, I'm talking about parties like Red Flag or Bandera Roja in Spanish that are communist parties that are in power of the opposition. So the strike came because we had real problems, and that was after 3.5 years of the government of Chavez, or 4.5 years, I'm sorry.
Martin Sanchez, your response?
Yeah, I think that it's obvious to world audiences that the strike was not a grassroots strike, and it was not a strike of the unions. It was a strike of the oil company management, and I think that It is obvious that I think people just should go to the web and check sources, because one can say, you know, whatever one wants on a radio show, but the truth is there. And Chavez actually, I think that the opposition actions is not only the strike but the coup and the destabilization of the economy. It shows also it's because of the class nature of the current situation here. You see local investors taking their money out because the opposition is telling everybody that Chavez is going straight into communism, and all their assets will be confiscated. So we'll be for 6 years we'll be waiting for that communism to come, and it just hasn't come. So you see foreign investors coming back into the country because they're figuring out that what the opposition is putting out is not true. So I do think that the economy would be in a lot better shape. We lost $14 billion just because of the oil strike in 2002. So, and just, you know, the coup had a big effect in foreign investors, and just the opposition and the overall, the way the media handles the country, the way the media portrays the country overseas, it just have a big effect on foreign investors and in local investors.
And what about the issue of the United States' role? Every day, 1.5 million barrels of oil from Venezuela reach U.S. shores. Venezuela is now the third largest supplier of foreign oil to the United States. Your comment, both of you, on the role of the United States in the internal problems of Venezuela.
Yeah.
Jorge Cambias.
Yes, there is something interesting there. Here in the United States, Chavez has been attacking the politics of Bush. But what is interesting is that the Democrats and the Republicans in the United States have a common position. If you go to John Kerry's website, you will see his position about what's going on in Venezuela. And he was backing the referendum also. He was saying, let the people express themselves what they want, especially in this political crisis. And he was saying also, saying that what we have in Venezuela is an authoritarian government, and this is the way that people will have the choice to select if they want Chavez to continue in power or not. So, and Chavez, what he has been doing in the last, especially in the last year, is threatening the United States, saying that he's going to cut the oil exports to United States. But he didn't find what he was looking for, that it was John Kerry's support. And I was in Washington about 2 months ago, and there was a hearing in the Senate, and it was interesting that both parties were in the same position. I mean, they were saying, let people express themselves. At that moment, we just had the possibility of having the referendum, but the government is persecuting opposition. It's going against people who support the opposition and people who are leaders of the opposition.
We just have 15 seconds. Martin Sanchez, your response.
Yeah, I think it's obvious that John Kerry is pursuing the Cuban right vote in South Florida after the fiasco of the last election with Bush and Gore. I think it's important for Kerry to gain the vote of the influential Cuban right in Florida. And I think with regard to the oil to the U.S., Chavez is just demanding respect. Chavez is more than willing and happy to deal with the U.S. and sell them oil, but he's demanding respect. That's why he said, well, if the U.S. threatens to overthrow the government or attempt to overthrow the Venezuelan government again and threatens our sovereignty, then, you know, there will be a stoppage of the oil shipment. So I think that Chavez, all Chavez demands is respect to Venezuelan sovereignty, and you know.
On that note, we're going to have to
the United States in a normal way.
We're going to have to leave it there. Martin Sanchez, webmaster of Aporia.org, and Jorge Cambeas, editor of the opposition website 11abril.com. Those websites, as well as Juan's piece in today's New York Daily News, beg big test for embattled populist. You can just go to democracynow.org and get all the links. Thank you very much for both of you being with us. When we return from our break, we're going to look at the case of a young man who was sentenced to die, convicted of murder, and now he's free. Stay with us.
I'm totally innocent, you know. I began to warm and chill to objects and their feels, a ragged cup, a twisted mop, the face of Jesus in my soup. Those sinister dinner deals, the meal trolley's wicked wheels, a hook bone rising from my food, and all things either good or ungood. And the mercy seat is waiting, and I think my head is burning, and in a way I'm yearning to be done with all this weighing of the truth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and anyway I told the truth. And I'm not afraid to die. I hear stories from the chamber. Christ was born into a manger, and like some ragged stranger, he died upon the cross. Might I say it seems so fitting in its way, he was a carpenter by trade, or at least that's what I'm told. My kill hand's tattooed evil across its brother's fist. That filthy five, they did nothing to challenge or resist. In heaven, his throne is made of gold.
The late Johnny Cash, Mercy Seat, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, a Louisiana court released 24-year-old Ryan Matthews from house arrest on Monday after exonerating him of a 1999 murder charge. Matthews was 17 when the 1997 murder of a grocery store owner took place and has served 5 years in prison. He was convicted based on questionable eyewitness testimony, even though his DNA did not match that on a ski mask worn by the murderer and found at the scene. The mask was retested after Matthews' lawyer heard in a 2003 that a convicted murderer, Rondell Love, had bragged to fellow inmates in a Louisiana state prison that he had committed the murder. Five new DNA tests have demonstrated that Matthews had no connection to the murder. Matthews had been under house arrest since April on a $105,000 bond. On Monday, Jefferson Parish District Attorney Paul Connick asked District Judge Henry Sullivan to vacate the bond.
Matthews is the 115th death row prisoner to be exonerated in the past quarter of a century and the seventh cleared in Louisiana since 1981. One of the three who'd been sentenced to death for crimes allegedly committed while they were juveniles. Last month, the American Bar Association and dozens of other groups, including 48 countries, filed amicus briefs in the U.S. Supreme Court case Roper versus Simmons, arguing that juvenile offenders do not have the, quote, heightened moral culpability that the Supreme Court requires for the imposition of the death penalty. The Supreme Court has not considered the applicability of the death penalty to juveniles for 15 years. We're joined right now by Ryan Matthews' mother, Pauline Matthews, by his attorney, Billy Southern, and by Emily Kunstler, who is a filmmaker, has been following this case for the last year and a half. We'll begin with Pauline Matthews. Your feelings today as your son has been released, at least to house arrest.
I'm very happy that Ryan is finally free, because the last 7 years has really been hard having my child incarcerated for a crime he clearly did not commit. You know, all the visits to Angola, the phone calls, Ryan's been away. It's been a burden, and it's been really been a burden that I'm glad that we had to hold on to hope that, you know, something would happen, and that the Louisiana Crisis Center and Reprieve and Amnesty and all the people that's been there for Ryan. But it's really good to have Ryan home and be free.
So he is totally free, finished with house arrest.
He's off of house arrest, and he's free, and he's able to move about and everything right now. You know, he was on house arrest for about a month, and he's free right now. And it's really a good feeling to have my child back.
And your sense over these years as the case developed and as he remained in prison despite the fact that there was no DNA evidence linking him to the crime, did you have hope during that period of time that he'd eventually be absolved of the crime?
I really didn't know whether he would be, eventually resolved of this crime, but I always knew that Ryan was innocent. I always believed in my heart that he was innocent. He always said he was innocent. So, you know, we always have to have hope. And, you know, I tried my best to have that hope for Ryan because I wasn't the one locked up. And I tried my best to hold my child up and let him have that hope that he would eventually be free.
Billy Southern.
And the day is here.
Billy Southern, you're Ryan Matthews' attorney. How did this happen? Why was he fingered? Why was he convicted?
Ryan was convicted and sentenced to death for the same reason that a lot of people in America are, because he was poor, because he's black, and because he didn't have the kind of power to fight against the sort of awesome power of the state. This case is a case of mistaken identification. It's a case where DNA evidence was ignored. It's a case where there was a biased jury and a biased system, and it was a case where another young man, Travis Hayes, who's still facing life in prison, made a false confession after being interrogated for hours and hours without attorney, without his parents present. In the end, you know, it seems like very possible that Ryan, if not for this DNA evidence that we found, could have been executed, could have really, this case could have gone all the way. So when I'm looking at the case, it just occurs to me that it would be a huge mistake if any of us ever viewed Ryan's case as either an indication that the system works or either as an isolated case. Ryan's case is a complete and total indictment of the death penalty and the way the system works. And any of us concerned about the process of justice in the United States should be appalled by what happened and not at all heartened by the fact that this exoneration has occurred.
And of course, Travis Hayes, who was the young man who at first said that he had been involved in the crime, is still in prison, isn't he? And is still serving a prison sentence, and there's an issue whether he should also be released?
Travis Hayes is completely and totally innocent of this crime. The only proof that they ever presented against Travis was that Ryan was the shooter. Now that it's obvious and manifest that Ryan's completely innocent, there's absolutely no proof that Travis is guilty, and yet he still sits in Angola prison facing a life sentence.
Emily Kunstler, it's great to have you back. Emily worked on the staff of Democracy Now! From the beginning and has gone on to make independent films. You've been following Ryan's case for a year and a half. What caught your interest? And you just came back from Louisiana when he was ultimately released.
Well, the reason that we chose to follow Ryan's case was because it highlighted all of the major problems with the death penalty. The fact that Ryan is black and impoverished, the fact that he was mentally retarded, the fact that he was a juvenile, and the fact that he was innocent. We thought that drawing attention to this case would raise questions about the death penalty on a larger level.
And how did you learn about his case?
We learned about his case through his attorney, Billy Southern.
What was it like when you were just in Louisiana when he was ultimately released?
It was really exciting. It's been really exciting to be. We've felt privileged to have been able to be a part of this process, and to have Ryan eventually released. It's not a happy ending though. Ryan's coming back. 7 years later with the experience of having been wrongfully accused, and what that's done to him, and still hasn't received a formal apology from anyone. And there's no indication that this won't happen again to anyone,
Billy Southern, in fact, the case is not over. It has, are they going to reopen this case? Could Ryan Matthews be charged again?
I think that's impossible at this point. It's somewhat discouraging that the district attorney's office would say that they're going to hold the case open, and I can only believe that they're simply posturing. Ryan and his family are remarkably strong people, and they're going to put back together the pieces of Ryan's life and fight on in this case, regardless of what anyone does. I think at this point, though, it's pretty much impossible for the state to bring a case against Ryan simply because there's overwhelming evidence that he's innocent and that someone else is guilty. And while I would never be surprised at anything that the prosecutors do, this would even be, I think, beyond reason even for them.
And Billy Southern, the district attorney who released him, Paul Connick, is this the same district attorney who originally indicted him, or has there been a change there in the office? And also, what kind of impact do you think this is having on Louisiana, the residents of the state, in terms of how they view the death penalty?
On the first question, Paul Connick is the same district attorney who was in charge of that office in 1997 when Ryan was originally charged. He's also the nephew of Harry Connick Sr., who's the longtime, very corrupt district attorney of New Orleans, and the father of famous Harry Connick Jr. Regarding how this case has played out in Louisiana, I think that for the large number of people of color, poor people in Louisiana, this case just affirms what they already knew, which was that there was no chance of them ever getting a fair shake in the criminal justice system. And for the people who are conservative, who dominate state politics, I think that this case is just something that they can ignore. But we've fought really hard, and Ryan and his family have fought really hard to make certain that people can ignore this case and that it is really important. And I hope that, through the resonance of the articles in the press in Louisiana, that we can really change things. However, sadly, this is the seventh exoneration in Louisiana in 6 years. So it really goes to show that something incredibly wrong is happening here with these cases, and that there's simply no safeguards in these most important cases, not only for manifestly innocent people, but for everyone in the system.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Billy Southern, lawyer for Ryan Matthews, Pauline Matthews, Ryan's mother, and Emily Kunstler, who is making a film on Ryan's case that will be completed soon. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Elizabeth Press, Anna Noguera, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Nell Geiser. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. For all contacts for links, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Next Wednesday night, August 18th, I'm very much looking forward to seeing folks at Berkeley Community Theater celebrating KPFA with Arundhati Roy, David Barsamian, and Boots Riley. And then to Denver on the 19th, and on Saturday and Sunday in Eureka and Hopland and Sacramento and Grass Valley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!